Back together again with you, hanging out Tuesday, September 17th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where I open the show wondering if we should be concerned about growing recreational marijuana sales in the state. CBS News Jerusalem correspondent Linda Gradstein had the latest on the Israel-Hamas war and reports of exploding Hezbollah pagers. University of New Haven senior criminal justice lecturer Ken Gray dropped by to talk about the latest apparent assassination attempt on former President Donald Trump, while Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio had her weekly update.
Well, I guess a lot of people, more and more people, are getting high in Connecticut. Is that where we are on this Tuesday, the 17th of September, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today? Are you listening to the program with a big, fat old doobie? just nice and fat there, and you got a good fatty going. Connecticut cannabis retail sales reaching a new high in August, approaching $18 million. The average price per gram falling for cannabis. This story by Kathleen Ravello. We've had her on the program before. From the Connecticut Inside Investigator, retail cannabis sales set a record high. Consumer protection data here in the state saying cannabis retailers, now these are the guys and gals on the retail level, sold about $17.989 million worth of adult use products in August. That number marking the best sales month for recreational cannabis since its sale became legal in January of 2023. It surpasses a record $17.175 million in December of 2023. Is this a good thing? Now, look, I'm not here to rain on anybody's parade. What do I say? As long as you're of, you know, legal age, you're doing this properly, you're not giving this stuff to kids or underage people or folks who are too old just to keep them doped up, sit there, Grandma, try this gummy. It's really good. No, I understand that, you know, adults will do what adults do. But again, and by the way, the number is 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You think that this would raise any sort of a red flag considering the reports of some of these wrong-way accidents and, you know, our law enforcement and traffic safety people in the state saying, well, hey, you know, in some of the situations here, we've had people in the state say, you know, in some of the situations here, yeah, we're finding, and I read you the numbers about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think these numbers came out, they're finding more and more of people involved in accidents where there were fatalities, either on the victim side or somebody who hit them or they hit that wasn't hurt, marijuana's involved. But again, people seem to buy more and more and more. And again, understand me here. I'm not criticizing any adult who legally uses something that is within their purvey to use. I get that. I understand that. But what if, let me play a little what if game here, or what people like to derisively call whataboutism. What if there was a report out that said, instead of, let me change a word or two here. Instead of, again, this is Catherine Ravello's story here in the Inside Investigator. What if instead of me saying Connecticut cannabis retail sales reached a new record high in August, what if I said Connecticut alcohol sales reached a new record high in August? Right? You probably go, oh, jeez, that's not good. Why are more people drinking? All right. Might be a valid case. Now, again, you'd have to factor in or factor out, well, 4th of July weekend, Labor Day weekend, Christmas, New Year's, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever, maybe somebody's birthday, end of the summer barbecues, whatever. But still, if we were talking about this, you might hear from health experts around the state, you know, well, we think this is a troubling trend here. Why are nutmeggers drinking more? Well, have you lived here for a while? Do you know that? What also if I substituted Connecticut cannabis retail sales, reaching a new record high in August? What if I said Connecticut tobacco product retail sales reached a new high in August? Oh, boy, you'd have all the usual people with you know, good interest out there. All those folks would be saying, well, gee, oh, my God, we're smoking more. We're chewing tobacco more. More Red Man is being sold. We're using more snuff. And you'd have the Lung Association and the Heart Association and this association and that association and the Association of Associated Associations. They'd have a special session in Hartford, and that's fine. That's within their purvey. But we continue to have, even as law enforcement has been telling us, hey, you know, this recreational weed thing, yeah, we're making money on it, but, you know, a lot of accidents here. We read that story a few months ago, right? An increasing number in Connecticut and some other states, an increasing number of people, either tragically victims or thankfully people who survive accidents, are testing more positive for THC in their system. But yet nobody says anything. Nobody says anything. There were approximately 467,000 adult-use products sold in August, a jump from roughly 419,000 sold the previous month. That figure sets another monthly record for the number of adult-use products sold, surpassing the old high in December of 2023. Apparently in December of 2023, a lot of folks got high with Santa and the missus. Are we turning a blind eye here to the possible deleterious effects of all this marijuana? Now, I'm not assuming everybody is using and using it, you know, not using it responsibly. I'm sure a lot of folks are. They're using it to take the edge off. You take a gummy, whatever. But isn't it interesting that we see these increased sales of marijuana products, of gummies, THC derivatives? That's fine. It's legal. But nobody says a word. I mean, if it was alcohol, if it was fatty foods, if it was tobacco products, oh, my God, we'd be sounding the alarm. But the weed, hey, the love affair with the marijuana just continues. Why are we turning a blind eye to this? As apparently more and more people want to get high. Remember, as bad as tobacco smoke is and cigarettes, you ain't getting high when you do it. You can have an alcoholic drink and not be drunk. But the first time you use something with THC, yeah, it's there. It's there. Back here on Connecticut Today for a Tuesday, some wild news out of the Middle East earlier today. You probably saw some of the headlines if you get news alerts or heard the story right here on WICC. Exploding pagers. What is up with that? And was it the Mossad or Shin Bet in Israel targeting folks? Joining us right now, CBS News correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Good to have you on. And explain what is going on with these so-called exploding pagers, and what is the latest on that?
Well, it's really like something out of Mission Impossible. Apparently, thousands of people, most of them Hezbollah members, were carrying these pagers that had lithium batteries, and they just started exploding. The pagers apparently came from Iran. So it's not clear. First of all, Israel has not accepted responsibility, but everyone believes that Israel is the one behind this. The Lebanese health minister said that at least 8 people were killed and 2,700 wounded, including 200 of them critically. So this is quite an extensive operation, and it really is a serious security blow to Hezbollah, which has been fighting Israel for almost a year since it started a day after Hamas invaded Israel and started this current war. But what's not clear is how exactly these pagers exploded, whether there was something already put in them beforehand, But in any case, it means that Hezbollah's communications are completely disrupted. And apparently they were using the pagers because they were afraid that Israeli technology could track their cell phones. So they didn't want to use cell phones.
Yeah, Linda, we hear pagers and we think, you know, man, 1980s, 1990s technology. But apparently, if Israel is behind this, the era of the technology, I guess, doesn't matter or didn't matter. And you just mentioned that they went with the old tech, worried about Israel, you know, tailing the new tech. Well, apparently, I guess, Linda, they can do that, right? I guess we have evidence here.
Right. I mean, you know, again, whether it was something that was implanted in the lithium batteries, who knows about whether it was a cyber attack. But, you know, it definitely increases the tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. But at the same time, it's also kind of, for many Israelis, it's a morale boost. You know, the war has been going on for almost a year with no sign of ending. The fact that Israel hasn't been able to completely get rid of Hamas in that year, it hasn't been able to rescue the hostages. And in fact, the mood of the country was extremely down. 2 weeks ago, the bodies of six hostages, including, someone who I knew, the Israeli-American Hirsch Goldberg Bowen, his parents, Rachel and John, are friends of mine and neighbors. And so the whole country has just been sort of depressed. And then there's this, you know, on one hand, again, Israel's not taking responsibility for it, although one of Netanyahu, the prime minister, one of his advisors, did put something on X kind of hinting that Israel was behind it, and then he quickly took it down. At the same time, Hezbollah is threatening revenge, and at least in some of the border communities along the border between Israel and Lebanon, Israel told the residents to stay near bomb shelters, fearing that Hezbollah is going to respond.
So the political standing, Linda, of Benjamin Netanyahu, is the pushback against him, Linda, still significant? Has it eased off? What is his standing right now? Is it as shaky as some of the Western media make it out to be, or not?
So there's two things. There's popular opinion against him, which is quite strong. They feel that he has mishandled the war. He has not taken any kind of personal responsibility for what happened on October 7th. And now, in the past couple of months, there's a sense that he is derailing a hostage deal for his own political causes because he does not want to go to an election that he wouldn't win. And there are two hardline parties in his government that have said they will bring down the government if he goes to any kind of a ceasefire deal that leaves Hamas still, existing. That said, the way the Israeli political system works, you vote for the party and not for the person. He has a majority of 64 out of 120. So that's only a majority, really, of three. At the same time, his government is relatively stable, and there really are not signs that his government is going to be brought down. All of this, what happened in Lebanon and the pagers and everything else, comes as he was considering and something that would have been extremely unpopular, replacing his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who's actually very popular, with Gideon Saar, the former political rival. And the idea is to bring him into the government and to fire Gallant. He has not been happy with Gallant's performance. Now, the last time he tried to do this, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, and that's expected that that's exactly what would happen again if he went ahead with this. Now this whole thing has, of course, been put on hold because of everything that's happening between Israel and Hezbollah. It's not popular, and yet his grip on power is still pretty strong.
Finally, Linda, is there a notion among maybe some people in Israel, in Jerusalem, in the government, in Tel Aviv, all over the country, that no matter what happens, Hamas will not accept any sort of a ceasefire?
Well, some people think that, and other people say that Hamas was prepared for a ceasefire if Israel was prepared to end the war, and that the blame is really on Israel because it has refused to agree to end the war. Now, what some people say is that if Israel leaves Hamas, even a weakened Hamas in power in Gaza, in another 2, 3, 5 years, the same thing that happened on October 7th will happen again. And so that Israel has to make sure that Hamas can never come back into power the way that it was. The critics of Netanyahu and the Israeli government say that he has refused to plan for any kind of a day after. He has refused to consider any kind of an alternative, a Palestinian alternative to Hamas. The Palestinians for many years have been divided, with Hamas in control in Gaza since 2007, and the Palestinian Authority, which is more moderate, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, in control in the West Bank. And the American plan originally was for a strengthened Palestinian Authority to take over in Gaza, as it was before 2007. And Netanyahu has completely not allowed that to happen. The head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is 88 years old, and he is also partly responsible in that he has not appointed a successor, and he has not done certain things that would convince Israel that he really wants peace. That said, Netanyahu has really made it impossible and has refused to even talk about anything that could happen at what's called the day after. In other words, at some point, this war, which has now been going on for almost a year, is going to end. It's exacted a very heavy price on both sides, a heavier price on Gaza. Of the 41,000 Palestinians that the Hamas health ministry says were killed, there's a new report by the Hamas Ministry of Education that says 11,000 of them were students between the first grade and 12th grade.
Linda Gradstein, CBS News, Jerusalem. Linda, thank you. We'll be in touch down the road. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
One of the gentlemen we check in with when there are things of national import regarding national security and or crime or the investigation of major breaches from time to time. He is a retired FBI special agent with 24 years plus of experience. He's now a senior criminal justice lecturer at the University of New Haven. Ken Gray back on the show. Ken, good to have you on. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Here we go again.
Yeah. First of all, Ken, I want to make sure you're not carrying any pagers today, are you? I just want to make sure, Ken.
You know, that what an incredible
oh, my
operation.
God. Oh, my God, Ken. How do they pull that off?
So Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah,
yeah,
told all of his followers to stop using cell phones because they could be tracked.
Yeah,
and so they bought a whole bunch of pagers from the one company.
Yeah,
and it's not clear whether there were explosives inside the pagers or if they were able to cause the batteries to detonate. But nonetheless, somehow, simultaneously across all of Lebanon,
jeez,
and Syria, these Hezbollah members who had these new pagers on ended up losing legs or parts of their hip,
yeah,
or their hands,
uh-huh,
or other parts,
yeah,
other body parts.
Other parts of their anatomy, and we'll leave it there. Yeah, the Mossad doesn't play around. But, Ken, now to a more serious situation here. Look, we had a news conference yesterday. We carried parts of it right here on WICC. Local officials, federal officials, state officials, Secret Service. So, Ken, as a guy who looks at these situations now and who was in the middle of this for more than two decades, what are your thoughts on this? And how difficult is it, Ken, to safely secure a golf course, for God's sake? What's going on here?
So golf courses are an extremely hard piece of real estate to secure because of the fact that they are such a large area. And so it's hard to lock down. But that being said, you know, this is a very interesting attack against former President Trump. And that the question I have that springs to my mind is, how did this guy know that President Trump was going to be on the golf course on that day?
Mm.
He wasn't from Palm Beach. He was from North Carolina previously, and he currently lives in Hawaii. And yet here he shows up in Florida. He shows up there in Palm Beach, and he's hiding in the bushes for 12 hours waiting for President Trump to arrive on the golf course. Now, it's President Trump's golf course.
Mm-hmm.
It is the Trump International Golf Course. It's a Sunday. It's probably there's a good possibility that he might be there. So maybe the guy was just playing the odds. But nonetheless, how did he know he was going to be there? He didn't know what time. He was there for 12 hours, but nonetheless, he did pick the right day. So how did he know that?
Yeah, and Ken, he didn't actually fire any shots, and I know there's a legal twist to this because he didn't do that, so he's being held on gun charges. But thankfully, the Secret Service and the other law enforcement there, the agents, I mean, they were scanning the area and somebody noticed this guy?
Yeah, so the detail works by in a situation like this, that some of the agents walk ahead, the hole ahead, to make sure that there are no threats in that area to where President Trump is going to go to the next hole. He was on the fifth hole, about 700 yards from the shooter.
Wow.
The next hole would have taken him much, much closer. And then when he transitioned from the fifth hole, from the sixth hole to the seventh hole, he would have walked right past the shooter. Consequently, the shooter was holding off on firing until he got closer. And because this agent was leading President Trump by a hole, looking through, all along the area to make sure there was no threats, he saw the barrel of the weapon sticking through the fence into the golf course. And so by seeing that, he immediately started firing at the shooter. I don't even know if he actually saw the shooter or if he was firing in that area because this gun was sticking through out onto the course.
So, Ken Gray, were there any failures here? Because we haven't really heard that, as opposed to what happened with the gunman on the roof in July in Butler, PA. But as you said, it's a difficult thing to do to secure a golf course, for God's sake. So in your mind, and again, this is from your 10,000-foot view, I understand that. Is there anything that sticks out at you, Ken, from this?
Well, you know, the Secret Service did a much better job in this case.
Mm-hmm.
They actually deterred the shooter. They were able to find him, to get him to address the threat, and then because of an eyewitness who came forward and said that he saw this guy run out of the bushes and get in a car, and here's a picture of his car and here's a picture of his plate. Because of that, this guy was quickly identified. His car was found quickly. And it stopped, and he was arrested. So very good all the way around as far as the tactical response. You know, they found the shooter, they stopped him from shooting, and that person was captured, arrested, and is going to stand trial over this. But here's the question is, how is it that he was able to get this close?
Well, yeah.
How is it that a shooter was able to get in this area? The area is very hard to secure. They were doing it by scanning ahead, by looking for such a threat. And so Secret Service comes out of this one looking much, much better. But I'd still like to know how he knew that Trump was going to be there.
Ken, to your knowledge, with your experience, and I'm sure they might not tell us, but, you know, at night they have things like infrared heat sensing and night vision goggles to see people that maybe you can't see. Is there anything to your mind that they use, for example, during the day, but that's a different environment with the sun up and everything? Or might they have something that is used in this case, in these cases, or not?
So, you know, the heat signature shows up at nighttime, but it doesn't show up if the temperature is really hot.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was there during the daytime. This was about 1:30 in the afternoon when the event happened. And so, to my knowledge, the only thing that you can do is actually go out there and beat the bushes, looking into the shrubs, seeing if there's any threat there. I heard on the press conference yesterday that they did have air assets in the area. Now, I don't know if that means that they had air assets in the area while he was playing golf or if they had air assets looking for this vehicle.
I got to tell you, Ken, no matter who wins in November, Mr. Trump or Ms. Harris, the vice president, whether it's your old agency, the FBI or the CIA or whatever, when they must twitch when they hear the word golf. I mean, listen, they do their jobs, obviously, but man, this is what I'm thinking. You kind of verified it earlier. Man, these golf courses are 7,000 yards, and I don't care whether it's just the president and his assistants or some dignitaries on the course. I mean, what a nightmare, like you said, to have to secure.
President Trump does not enjoy the same benefits as a sitting president does, President Biden. But even if President Biden was out on the golf course, it would be very difficult to keep him totally safe because of the fact that it's such a wide open space. In this case, surrounded by shrubbery, it's just too big a space like that. And so you would have to just about have people standing, shoulder to shoulder to one another, ringing the entire area.
Well, Ken, maybe whomever wins again in November for future presidents, Ken, how about an indoor golf simulator? You know, the ones where, seriously, put one in the White House. This way, any chief executive, Ken, can play any course, wherever in the world, any day, and you guys and gals don't have to worry about it, right? Good idea, you think?
Yeah. I think that would be a good suggestion, but I don't think President Trump takes suggestions.
No,
I think he's going to play golf.
I think he will. Ken Gray, University of New Haven, retired FBI special agent, 24-plus years. Ken, thank you. We appreciate the time, as always, and we'll chat down the road.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate it. Time for our weekly check-in every Tuesday at this time. Megan Portfolio, blogger, writes the Hartford Portfolio for the Yankee Institute. Megan, good afternoon, and how are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
I'm living the dream, Megan. Like I tell people, it's too late for law school or med school now. So one of my callers thinks divinity school for me, but I'm like, no. I was an altar boy once. That's enough. That would be enough.
No, don't do that. We need you here on the radio.
Well, thank you.
I
appreciate that. Now, before we get to your latest piece here, have you noticed any windmills popping up around you, Megan? I want to get your thought on that before we go to your piece about the unions. Do you think, in the stuff that you cover, is Governor Lamont honestly concerned about the consumers here, or is this just like, let's get past the legislative elections? What do you think, from your point of view?
I think it's a little of both. I think he's a smart guy. I mean, he ran a business. He's been kind of okay fiscally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he at least is, like, keeping our guardrails in check. So that's been good. So, yeah, I think that he is conscious of the fact that ratepayers are livid and that we're already, like, well, not you, Paul, because you live in Wallingford.
Sorry.
The rest of us.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Go ahead. Yes.
I think he realizes that. It's worth exploring. It's worth looking into it, digging into it, see where the market's going. What's the Fed going to say? So he does have that mindset, but I'm sure he's also getting, well, I know he's getting it from the progressive wing of his party.
Yeah.
They're hammering him. I mean, they keep getting the calls of action, you know, to contact him. So he's just trying to walk a thin line. So I think it's a little of both, but, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, I don't want to say for sure that, oh, he's going to wait and, you know, see what the market's like, see where the pricing falls. If it's too high, he'll just take a pass. Or are we going to be like the day after election and it's going to be like, oh, just kidding, JK, guys, we're going to be doing win.
Imagine that if he came out and said, sorry.
That'd be a great quote.
Fooled you, JK, just kidding. All right, now to your latest piece here regarding in the Hartford Portfolio regarding unions. And I know that's one of your favorite topics. What do you have for us there?
Yes, and I apologize. I know this is not a sexy topic. But sometimes the non-sexy topics in government are the ones that affect us.
Yeah.
So for the past few years, the unions have been trying to get taxpayers to fund their strikes. And I've talked about this on your show before. Mm-hmm. I've written about it a million times. They've originally wanted the workers to get unemployment insurance. Well, you know, that's nice and it sounds nice, but guess what happens if they have to tap those funds?
Mm-hmm.
That increases costs for business.
Sure.
And you know what that happens?
Sure.
That increased costs for us. Mm-hmm. So that has failed year after year. I think maybe 2 or 3 years in a row it just died.
Yeah.
So then, you know, you remember this year they brought it up again, and this time they wanted like the regular taxpayers to fund it with this special slush fund.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got some good news. The unions have figured out a way to be self-reliant and fund their own strikes.
Okay.
And the president of the AFL-CIO has been sending around emails encouraging people to make donations, voluntary donations to a strike fund to help support the workers on strike in New Haven, the Omni Hotel workers. It's about 120 of them that are on strike. They're demanding fair wages, and I guess their contract had been expired and the negotiation's been at standstill.
Yeah.
But the unions are actually asking for donations from their members so they can fund their own strike. So hopefully this is like going to last and I don't have to see this stupid bill again because I'm kind of sick of writing about it.
Yeah, and you know, listen, a lot of us grew up, I guess I'm still technically in a union. I haven't paid into it in 20 or 30 years because I've worked, my son's in a union. You know, there was always that concept, Megan, of, you know, a strike fund, right? There was a union strike fund, and it was a deduction from your paycheck weekly or every other week or once a month or whatever. But when this bill popped up, I went, huh. Now, I guess the people that support this say, what, it's going to even out the playing field because, what, some employers can just wait out the strike. And that's not fair, right? Was that their main argument for this?
Yeah, but it's kind of ridiculous. So now you're going to put the government put their finger on the scale, and the government shouldn't be involved in any of these mm-hmm. disputes whatsoever. It actually on social media, I keep seeing all of these politicians at the strike walking the picket line for fair wages, but it's kind of funny. The ones walking the picket line were the ones that shut the state down and kind of screwed over the hotels. And they were also the ones that created this, the minimum, they jacked up the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you created these policies. So what are you saying? Your minimum wage isn't a fair, I mean, I'm totally against the government dictating wages for companies. Mm-hmm. I think that's ridiculous that ever became a thing. It's a contract between a worker and an employer. The government shouldn't be involved, but they're the ones that invented the minimum wage. And they're the ones that shut down the hotels that really kind of hurt their business for years. I know some of them in my area haven't recovered or they've shut down. So you've got these politicians that are part of the problem walking the picket line because, oh, gee, it's an election year. Let me get my picture mm-hmm. taken. And gee, I could use the extra help with my door knocking. So I'm going to show up at these union rallies and, you know, draft some more people to help me win my election.
And one business, Megan, in fact, I read a story the other day where it's really starting to have a deleterious effect, is, of course, fast food places. They're trying to one-up each other, you know, a value meal here, a combo meal here, you know, and their bottom line profit on that's like 50 cents or a dollar or something like that. Yet, you know, in California, there's some, I guess, the fast food wage is approaching $20, and I'm reading where, and I forgot what chain it was, but a couple of owners said, listen, we have to shut six of our restaurants because we can't. I mean, this isn't working. So you're right. If you go beyond the tipping point of what a fair wage is, and if that's somehow dictated by the government, it ends up costing jobs because a private sector employer is going to say, listen, I'm not going to kill myself for 30 cents profit on a value meal, right?
Well, they're also turning to automation because
yes.
mm-hmm. robots don't take breaks. They mm-hmm. don't get sick. They just work. And so I think it was Chipotle just announced that they're experimenting with a guacamole maker. It's a machine that just makes the guacamole. So it's like now you're, I mean, this warning has been out there. I remember when the minimum wage debate in Connecticut went around,
yeah.
and this was one of the arguments, and you could eliminate jobs. And you're seeing as AI gets smarter and
oh yeah.
we're relying on it more, you're going to start seeing a lot of these jobs being replaced with robots and AI. And that's, you know, I don't know where those workers go. I mean, I guess there's a market for if you want to go back to school for manufacturing and
sure.
help with making this AI and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good in that aspect. But some of these jobs, I mean, I worked in fast food for years to
you
help
did.
Pay for college. I mean, some of the stuff that we did there, I mean, French fries can be done by a robot, and I worked in the grill, and a lot of that stuff we did in the grill could easily be done by a robot.
So were you good with the French fry basket, the deep fryer there, and on the grill? Did you have a nice action there?
I worked at a franchise store. We were very, we like adhered to all the policies. We were like very strict. I was one of the managers. So
really?
We ran a ship. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Our workers like took pride.
What was that? Yeah, you broke up a little. Your workers what?
I said our workers, they took a lot of pride in their job.
Nice.
And it was,
nice.
Yeah, our restaurant was always clean. And
nice.
I mean, I was kind of a stickler.
Well,
and
good
kind
for
of a
you.
Pain in the butt, but.
Good for you. You cracked the whip. Do you want to
cracked
tell
whip,
us?
But.
Do you want to tell us what franchise that was or not? I can understand if you don't want to.
It was in Plainfield, Connecticut. And the truth, and you know what's true?
Okay.
We all shut down the ice cream machine because we don't want to have to spend all night cleaning it because I have to get cleaned every night.
Wait a minute. You said,
so,
screw this. We're not
going to.
Wait a minute. So you, in your rogue days, before you were a conservative pro-business person, you shut down an ice cream machine? Wow.
Yeah, we would tell customers that the gas. So if you hear that the gasket blew, it just means they didn't want to keep the machine up all night because it takes forever to clean.
Wow. So look what we get from
I'll never be employed by them again.
Look what we get from Megan Portfolio. We find out that there was a little subterfuge there, and she said they're going after the guac at Chipotle. Wow.
Yeah, I actually, I don't know how I feel about that. I'd rather have like a worker make
guac. Come on, Jesus, carving out avocados. It's the Hartford Portfolio of the Yankee Institute. Megan, thanks. And now I have to like reassess this when I have you on next week. Like, wow. She shut down the
argument. Facts I have about myself that you're learning about.
Excellent. Megan, thanks. Have a happy rest of the week. Take care.
You too. Bye.
All right.